Petition number 22353, Reel 7.
Eric Warburton, Reel 7.
Yes, the difficulty had been that we were warned, or so the Dutch people said, that there were tanks in this area and we had not accepted their advice. It's always difficult in a war situation. You don't know who to believe and who not to believe. And there were lots of people who were not reliable upon, but they had to rely upon the wisdom of our own intelligence people as to whether you accept what they say or whether they don't, you don't. And anyway, we were in this position, and again, I got called. Well, I was always sort of on duty, as it were, whenever this sort of situation arose, and always ready to be called upon. And as you know, in the people who were fraternizing with the Germans, particularly the girls, were shaven, had their heads shaven, and a guard appeared with this girl, and he wasn't going to let her go either way. So, and it transpired that she was suffering from scabies, and I said, "Well, you have to stay with her just a moment while I go and get some assistance." And I went, found one of the MOs, a young MO it wasn't, so he said, "Oh, I'll come with you." And so he said, "Get rid of the guard." And I said, "Oh, all right, and that's a bit difficult." He won't let go, sort of style. So eventually I had to be firm with this guard and to, leave it with us and go away. And have her back in a minute or two. So we then he said, "Well, tell her to strip off." And this I did, obviously. And there we had this naked girl in front of us. And so he took a bowl of this benzoate, and I had one. And he said, "Right, we'll start from the feet and work up." And this girl must have been in a terrible situation. A, the embarrassment of it, but B, this stuff is cold as it goes on. Just imagine being brushed all over by this sticky mess that one had to use for treatment of scabies. And then we came to the position, the vital point of breasts. And so I looked at him hesitantly, and he looked at me, and he said, "Lift them up, they'll do you no harm." And we continued and painted this girl from head to foot with this stuff. And then I had to fetch the guard in and say, well, she dressed, and then fetch the guard in, and he took her away. I used to get these jobs, and I say, once you do them, it's yours for life type of thing. Anyway, that was another incident at that particular place. And then we started to assemble for the move around a different way. That was a move over to the left and go and proceed up through some minor roads through Elst and Driest. And that was very close to the water, close to the river, and in fact over one area of river. The river bends rather like an S bend, and it created quite a problem, and it created a problem for us insofar that we were put in this field and said, "Dig down and make sure that you go down as far as you can." And of course, one had not to go more than about 4 feet, and you hit the water level of the rivers. And amidst all this going on, the brigade were all in the same field next to us, and in front of us, as it were. We weren't looking, we were looking ahead towards the north, and we there was fire behind us, and we started getting 88 millimeter shells coming over, rather than landing rather closely. And that continued for 36 hours, and we had now gone as far as we dug down as far as we could, and we'd heaped up the removed earth up as far as we could get it up, and our little section sat around in this hole. 15 of us had dug this thing, which is about quite a sizable size, enough to make it size like a gun emplacement, which would be about what, 15 by 15 or something of that nature, more than that possibly. And we're sitting round this and this bombardment continued incessantly, which was rather difficult to cope with, really, I suppose. And until one of the chaps, the other side of the trenches, we sat sort of huddled up in this hole. Don't you think it's about time you said a prayer? To me, this was, which I obviously couldn't refuse. Obviously, I was quite happy to do so. But it just shows the intensity and of the fire, and the these chaps were feeling now that things were getting a bit close. In fact, we all knew from experience that the brigade commander had got the ability to whistle up some rocket firing typhoons. Half a dozen, we were always told, that you could always be brought up to fight, you know, and get removed any problems. And we all wondered where and why and how he didn't do it. But there it was, and because this fire was coming from the south of us, which was behind us. Couldn't believe that they got behind us, but they had, by virtue of this river doing this snaking behind us. It snaked, and it meant that you had the opinion that they had the ability for them to be behind us, although not at the other side of a river or on a rivulet, because the rivulet lek goes one way and the river Vaal goes the other way, and it forms an island, and we were on the island. And then it joins up again and goes into Amsterdam eventually, Muiden, later on. But then one of these shells dropped in a trench in the field in front of us, which was the brigade HQ. And as a result of that, there was a lot of... we didn't get called in to deal with it, but I understand, because I've met a chap since who was in the trench and was injured, and then the brigadier called up these aircraft, and they, from behind us and behind a barn, comes out these six self-propelled guns. And that was the end of that little saga, and we felt a bit easier after that. But of course, somebody had to get hurt before anything positive was done. But ahead of us, of course, was the Dorsets preparing to swim the river and to get the men out from Arnhem. And it was rather right through the back door, and so they did swim the river. Did what they could, and they got about 2,300 men out. And in fact, I know a member of our own branch who swam the river six times, a major, who was a major in the airborne. And the river was a very swift flowing river, and it must have been a very hard job to do that. I know, it needs a lot of strength. But we got these chaps out, and then we had to get out ourselves, I suppose. Well, I'm talking about generally. The Dorsets did the job, and all credit to them. And our instructions were then to get out, and in due time, it so happened it was in the middle of the night that we came back across the main river, back into Nijmegen. Well, by this time the engineers had formed a pontoon bridge for our use, or for everybody's use, but for our use in getting back into Nijmegen. And what they'd done was put pontoons together facing the flow of the river, and so we can imagine all these boats being put side by side across the river, and then planks going across there to form the road, as it were. And these 3-ton lorries, we had these lorries that we used were 3-tonners, and you can just imagine that as the front wheels went on to the barge or whatever, the pontoon, the vehicle went down, the back end came up, and when the next sort of change over, the thing went the opposite way. You were like a seesaw going over this thing, over this river. That's the only time I can recall having taken my boots off, just in case we finished in the drink. it was quite something, and quite a memory really. And amidst all this, when we were struggling to get over there in this darkness, they switched the searchlights on. And when we got to the other side, they said, well, of course, the reason that the searchlights had to go on was that there were frogmen about. And they just wanted to sort them out if they were there. So that was that. Back to Nijmegen and back into something like sensibility again. Yeah. Having got back to Nijmegen, we were then discovered that we were going in for a rest, and the idea was to send us down to towards Tilburg. But and in fact, we made our journey down towards there, and it got late, of course, and we were being sorted out. And I remember going into a billet, which they. The ladies and whatever of the houses were wakened, and we were put into these places. And two of us were in this house, and we were shown into a bedroom. a Belgian bed is quite something.
Is and it in Tilburg?
Well, it's just outside Tilburg. And so we were... Yeah, shown the bed, and the lady was a bit reluctant, and she locked us in in the room, which was a bit anything, but we couldn't care less. There was a bed. We were happy to sleep on something nice and soft, and so that was okay. But that was short-lived, because in the early hours of the morning we were roused. Everybody turned out again. We were on our way to the Ardennes, and created quite a bit of a stir, because we thought we'd had quite a long time in the line, and here we were going off again. We arrived at a place called Grote Spoon, Grote, and I think it was Spoon, and we settled in there, and the forward troops went on, and we were now in a position to receive any casualties. And for that purpose, there was a school. And that there was a greater problem. The local populace was in great difficulty medically, and we were asked to half a dozen of us normally, were asked to form a clinic in this school. And it, so they said, you know, will you do it? And we arranged for 9 o'clock in the morning and 6 o'clock in the evening. And the place was crowded, and everybody had scabies, and this was quite something. In the army, of course, we had this treatment was benzoate, which was a sticky white mess, and which you sort of covered over these problems, the areas, and that made a cure. And but the thing was that we had babies from 3 or 4 months old, right up to when we got to the stage of young ladies of 21 coming, and we now had our experience told us that unless you treated every part, every of the body that was affected by the scabies, then you were not able to cure the rest of the, cure it as a whole. When they arrived, and we just jibbed at that and said, well, there's a bottle of this medicine or this treatment, take it away and do it yourself. But the people were very grateful, and they arrived with their money, and of course we had no use for money. So unfortunately they went sadly away with their money in their pockets, and with a promise that they would come back again because they needed continual treatment for a day or two. And so we then discovered that somebody had said to them, one of the things that we would like was some eggs. So imagine 30 or 40 people arriving the next day, all with eggs. We had eggs cooked in the normal way, scrambled, any type of egg you could feel. There was there was this situation of eggs, and we had more eggs than we could ever dream about, and so that was a problem. However, that was Grosbone, and we did a good job there, and eventually, because of the situation, and we were no longer anti-paratroops, then we were sent on our way up towards Holland again, and we came eventually into the area of Brunsum, and we went into the little place alongside it, was called Rumpen. And here again we were given a school in which to carry out our medical centre. Now we were in deep snow and very cold, and as a result, as you probably know, there was no activity on the front whatsoever. This was in the Reichswald Forest, or the Black Forest, I should say. And then everybody was bogged down into trenches, and we had various, the usual stream of people coming back with minor injuries in the main, but we also had the locals to deal with, because they had been badly injured by various mortars and whatever, gunfire. Particularly, they had been burnt a lot. And we had only been open a day or so, and this little boy came in, about 9 years old, and it came onto my shift, and so we dressed his leg, which was it was a piece of shrapnel that damaged his leg, and so I said, looked at his leg and looked at it, and he told me this was his school, this was his school room, etc. And so we looked at the leg again and said, well, where he'd been had my treatment, we'd now cleaned him up, the rest of his body looked quite a different colour. So I said, would he like a wash? Oh yes, he would. So we gave him a piece of the old sunlight soap and sent him off, and he knew where the ablutions were and all the rest of it. And so he disappeared and came back shining as a new pin, and off he went quite merrily. Next day he returned, but now there were two boys. And so I said to him, "What's the matter with your friend?" "Nothing," he said. "He wants a wash." So we fitted him up, and the two of them now went off quite merrily with this. But he returned each day for his treatment. And eventually this came to an end, because I said to my colleagues, it's a bit difficult to get rid of this boy in a brutal way, so I will, I've told him to come at the termination of my shift, so you tell him not to come again, then I shall feel much happier that he doesn't come again, and I haven't had to tell him.
Why did you want to keep coming?
Oh, for treatment, and because he liked coming, and there was a bit of I don't know, he just liked to be there with us. And anyway, so the next day all was set up, and this was going to happen. But in fact, right at the change of the meeting, they brought a baby in. And for some reason or other, I get all these special jobs to do. And this baby took me over my time. Of the changing over the shift, and so therefore, instead of four of us working on this particular table, there were eight, eight milling around, and where's the boy? And I turned round, and he was right by my side. So I had to take the bull by the horns and say, "You're not. There's no need for you to come again." But then he said, "I know," and he pulled out from behind his back, as it were, a little piece of wood shaped, and the bark, sliver of wood with the needle and pin cushion and etc. on it. And a little inscription on it, and he said, "My mother would like you to have this, because you've been so kind." I didn't know what to do. I felt very embarrassed, and we parted, and I didn't say, "But do you know, I still have that here, in as a memento, and it's the only thing that I have as a memento from that particular thing, and it was given to me." So that was another incident. The other one was that as soon as we arrived, I was immediately involved in setting up the business, as it were, of the surgery and dispensing sort of thing. So. And one of our chaps, who was on the opposite shift, went out and came back, and he said, "Oh, I've got news for you. You've got a date." And I said, "Oh, what's all this about?" And he said, "Well, as you know, whenever you meet anybody in Holland, or we met anybody in Holland as soldiers, the first thing they want to know was, what religion were you? Because it's a highly saturated Catholic area." And he said, "I hitched a lift off a milkman, and he said, first thing he said, so, what religion are you?" And he said, "Oh," I told him that I was a Baptist. And so this chap, he said to him, "Well, I'm a Salvationist." "Oh," he said, "we've got one of your lot with us." And so he said, well, "Will you arrange for him to see these people at the necessary place at Hunsbrook, really? And they'd like to meet him." So my next day off, I went off to and met these people at Hunsbrook, and people who came became known to me as Mama and Papa. They said, "Where are you sleeping?" And I said, "We're on the second house, in the second house, and we're on the laundry floor." And they said, "Not anymore. There is, we live just around the corner, and there is a bed for you as long as you're here." And which obviously I took advantage of this situation, and insofar that it suited me fine. And there was a young lady at the house, and still at school, and nobody speaks English in that area, or didn't at that time. And so, but this girl wants to learn English, and so I was desperate to learn more Dutch than I knew at that time, and so we studied between the two of us, and my vocabulary of the Dutch language grew daily, and so it was very, very good.
Did you say this was at Hunsbrook?
Yeah, Hunsbrook. Hoensbrug, Hoensbrug, I think it was. And that was a very good arrangement as far as I was concerned. And we had some long time there, because we had to winter it out, and everybody was stalemate, and nobody could go anywhere. And We obviously established ourselves, and the people were anxious, because they thought that at any moment the Germans would break through, and they would be back to square one. We in turn were quite convinced that we were there to stay, and so that was the no problem as far as we were concerned. We did have some casualties, obviously. And some were serious, and they were coming back from the front, and that was just down the road, so we had them to deal with, and that we lost our one and only casualty at that time, and he was brought in and very badly injured, and we had a situation where we'd got a new young MO joined us straight from England, and he, quite frankly, was at a loss what to do. And we said to him, "Well, the man is losing blood and etc., and so give him an injection of." So we prepared and then the various sites for him, and he was always too late every time to impart this, and he stood there with his syringe in his hand, rather like if he'd got a pen, just rather he would be on the wards in England, I think, until the end. He said, "Well, do something for him, if he was only trying to get it in his feet or in his ankle." So unfortunately the man died owing to this procrastination, and so we had a few words with him and with the MO, and told him what we thought. But anyway, that was all part and parcel of the job. And
how did he take it?
We didn't see him very much after that. Of course, I think that he felt that he ought to be somewhere else other than with us. And I don't think we saw him at all after that incident.
Did you take over his
functions? Well, we weren't medical orders, we weren't medical officers, but I mean, we couldn't really, I suppose, have told him off, but he deserved having off, and we felt that way, and we weren't blamed for doing it at all. So that was the situation there, and Ron Saps Ford was buried in the cemetery at Rumpen, and he was well looked after. The grave was well looked after by our Dutch friends. So then we moved over then up towards Nijmegen again to in preparation for the push into Germany. And we didn't go into the centre of Nijmegen, we skirted round the outside because there was this was the last piece of Holland still to be liberated, and that was in the Lochem area. And so en route there we passed round the top end of the Siegfried Line, which